Before we begin, a warning. Today's episode contains scenes which describe child loss, also strong language and drug references. Please be aware. Morning, Matt.
Morning, Alice. And morning, whoever this guy is.
Oh, that's Mike.
Okay, who's Mike?
He's my new boyfriend.
Okay, well, congratulations. But why is he in the recording studio with us?
Oh, he just said he'd pop along and just, you know, riff a bit, chuck in a few ideas, freshen the whole thing up.
Okay, I don't think it needs freshening up, and I think British Scandal's just you and me.
Yeah, Mike doesn't agree. He said it's sounding a bit stale, it just needs a little bit something, zesty was the word that he used. Something to, you know, make it pop.
Why is he making bird noises?
That's one of his big ideas.
Can we talk outside?
Anything you can say in front of Mike.
It's about Mike.
Right. That does make it awkward. Mike, babe, go get us a can of pop.
And pop your pants on, mate. You'll scare the receptionist.
August 19th, 1966. Memphis, Tennessee. John Lennon lies flat on his stomach, cheek pressed against the rough carpet of the Greyhound bus. Brian Epstein has arranged for the Beatles limousine to travel ahead, to make sure they get through the crowd unscathed. The noise outside is deafening. But today, it's not the frenzied teenage screaming the Beatles are used to. This is lower, deeper, and charged with threat.
Beatles, go home! Jesus died for you too, John Lennon!
Next to John, George has crammed himself into the footwell. He stares deep into the middle distance. Ringo is crouched in the aisle, trying to light a cigarette, but his thumb keeps trembling on the spark wheel. Furious, John curses himself. Why couldn't he have kept his bloody mouth shut? He said it 4 months ago. A throwaway joke.
Christianity will go. It will vanish and shrink. I needn't argue about that. I know I'm right, and I will be proved right. We're more popular than Jesus now.
Strictly on record sales, he's probably right.
On catering, no.
He barely even remembers saying it. No one in Britain had really read it, and those that had didn't care. But in the US, it caused uproar. Through every state, the Beatles have been trailed by furious protesters. Radio stations have banned their songs. Former fans have burned their singles. Bullet holes have been found in their private jet. And now, this. The bus stops. The doors hiss open. The crowd's wrath is unbearable now.
John Lennon must die.
Laid flat across the back seat, Paul quips, his voice slightly shaking.
Send John out. It's him they want.
John doesn't laugh. Paul's got a point. He stands up, grasping a blue leather seat to steady himself. The voices get louder. An orange glow fills the bus. John feels the heat on his face. Outside, white hooded figures of the Ku Klux Klan cluster round a bonfire. And on the fire is an effigy. With his dark hair, his polo neck, his trademark sunglasses. Out of nowhere, the crowd's rumbling is shattered by a bang. John's body goes cold, numb. He waits for the bullet to pierce his chest. The searing pain, the blood. Instead, nothing. He turns back to the band. They're all staring, clearly expecting to see him on the floor. In a cracked, throaty voice, he manages,
"All right, boys. Just a firecracker."
He staggers off the bus, forces a smile, but his knees are trembling. These people want him dead. And for the first time, right then and there, he asks himself if he really wants to continue with this. Not just with the gig, but with the band. Is it time to break up the Beatles?
From Wondery, I'm Alice Levine.
And I'm Matt Ford.
And this is British Scandal. Matt, it's not very common on British Scandal that we tell a story and we think, I have a real affinity with that protagonist. I can put myself in their shoes. I know how they felt. But now, here we are.
I mean, Lennon and McCartney, we're going through basically what they went through. We're part of a hit outfit that's constantly at the top of the charts, winning awards. I mean, this feels like it was written about us.
I mean, you in particular, with the Lennon part of this story, I'm seeing so many parallels.
Yeah, when you think of his creative work, it's just like me next week hosting the Jersey Society of Chartered and Certified Accountants Awards dinner.
You know that feeling of being in demand. You know that feeling of being the man of the moment. And so this must really resonate.
It does, and it scares me.
Just the heady heights of fame and excess. I'm desperately trying to make this analogy work. But last episode, we did hear about the fans, the pressure of management, John Lennon desperately trying to keep his family life together while the work just took over.
Yes, and the pressure he's under is forcing him to find relief. And it feels like the person that we met at the end of the last episode, Yoko Ono, is going to play a big part in John Lennon's life.
Which brings us on to episode two, All You Need Is Love.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
9 months later, the 14th of May, 1967. John and Cynthia Lennon's house, Surrey. John nervously leads Japanese artist Yoko Ono into the sunroom. This is John's safe space, where he writes new material. He doesn't normally allow anyone else in. Until now, he hadn't realised how cluttered it is. Gnarled bits of paper, covered in sketches or song lyrics, line every surface. Books and music equipment are scattered across the floor. But Yoko doesn't seem to notice. She keeps her dark eyes fixed on his, expectant. John takes a deep breath, like he's terrified of letting her down. He selects a tape from a hand-drawn box and crams it into the cassette player. Until now, he's never shared these tapes with anyone. It's all out there stuff, part comedy, part electro. When Cynthia had walked in on him recording them, she exclaimed that it gave her a migraine. But somehow, he's convinced Yoko will understand. He watches her, the way she lowers herself to the ground, crosses her legs in one slick, delicate movement, twirling a joint between her fingers. She waits, head tilted to one side, thick dark hair cascading down her back.
Well?
There it is again, that challenging smile.
Aren't you going to press play?
John watches as she listens, still for the most part, but with every nod, laugh, sway of her head, he feels like he grows 10 feet. John persuaded Cynthia to take a 2-week holiday to Greece so that he could tempt Yoko to come over.
I tell you where's good for getting rid of migraines, actually. Fortnight in Greece, clear it up like that.
Antiparos, that's far away, isn't it? Not the mainland, like somewhere you need to get a hovercraft to. Yoko stands up. He's about to hit pause when he sees Yoko's head is tilted towards the music, as though held by some magnetic force. Sounds begin emanating from her mouth. First notes, then chirrups, birdsong. John closes his eyes. The sounds weave intricately with the electro beat, as though it never existed without them. His heart thuds. He finds himself reaching for a delay button, recording and playing back sections of the track, letting the jumbled parts reverberate around the room in harmony. John's playing, not with his head, but with his body, guided through the music by Yoko's voice, her movements. No words, no discussion, just pure emotion. He's never experienced collaboration like this before, not even with Paul.
Because Paul can play instruments.
But he cannot tempt an American eagle to the windowsill.
Can you do an impression of a magpie, Paul? Well, then this band is over.
8 hours later, John is slumped across the plush pink velvet sofa, naked. He hasn't slept, and the sunlight streaming through the floor-to-ceiling windows is making his eyes sting. Yoko lies in his arms, wearing only Cynthia's dressing gown. The rough toweling digs into his flesh. A door opens. A woman screams. In his stoned, exhausted state, it takes him a few seconds to realise it's Cynthia, back early from her holiday, throwing down her suitcase and glaring at the artist in her husband's arms. Reddening, John rolls hurriedly off the sofa and grabs a nearby sheet, while Yoko rises wordlessly to her feet and gathers up her underwear as though she expected this all along. As she reaches the door, she turns back to look at him with a longing that sucks him in. John turns to Cynthia, sees the colour has drained from her face. Apologies start pouring out of his mouth, the platitudes he uses every time his infidelity is discovered. He wraps his arms around her and feels Cynthia relax into him. He begins running his lips along her neck, making love to her like he always does when he gets caught out. Lying in bed afterwards, though, all he can think of is Yoko. He's never felt such connection, emotionally, creatively. The way she challenges him, makes him work for her love. John feels as though his eyes have been opened and that he needs to see her again, as soon as he can. June 1967, Abbey Road Studios, London. Is this where I bring up that I've recorded a number one single at Abbey Road Studios, or do I do that later?
Hang on. What number one single was it?
Oh, thank you for asking. It was actually for charity. I hate talking about my charity work. But it was a choir version of Avicii, Wake Me Up. I'm not taking any more questions at this time.
That got to number one. That is amazing. And what was your part in the single?
It was very low in the mix, it turns out. Almost hard to identify my voice, which I presume was some kind of clerical error. Yoko follows John into the booth, her hand clasped in his. As a classically trained musician, she's no stranger to recording studios. Yet she can't help but feel a jolt of excitement as she takes in the room. The plush, soundproofed carpet, the walls lined with gold Beatles discs, the large team of sound engineers poring over a desk.
John, is this where they recorded that Avicii charity single with Anna Slavine? Yes, she was low in the mix.
Heads rolled after that. Yoko has to admit she's beginning to fall for John. Over the past few weeks, she's been surprised to discover that underneath the cocky exterior of the great John Lennon is a pain and vulnerability that echoes her own. The child of wealthy but emotionally distant parents.
British Scandal classic.
Yoko has spent her life searching for love and meaningful connections, often through her art. And she's never met anybody who understands that quite like John. John's keen to take the Beatles in a new avant-garde direction. And he's convinced collaborating with her is the way to make that happen. Yoko hadn't needed much persuasion. Her artwork might span different mediums, but within each piece is a common thread. Her belief that art should unite people and not simply be mounted on a wall, inaccessible. And what could be more accessible than popular music? But as Yoko takes in the blank faces of Paul, Ringo and George, she realises John has not told them she's coming. Yoko turns to John, irritated. How could he? but John's mouth sets into a firm line.
Yoko's joining us today.
So this is the first time that Yoko effectively is inserted into the Beatles.
And what an unfair way to do it. To ask to join them, to help them, to collaborate, and actually nobody has been given any sort of heads up.
I mean, he's not someone that tells people the direct truth, whether it's his wife or whether it's Paul, George and Ringo. And also, it's a bit of a power move.
Definitely. Yoko perches herself awkwardly on an amp and listens as Paul begins strumming a new potential track. The booth brims with an uneasy tension. She tells herself she just needs to prove she's the right artist to work on the album. That she's not just here because of John. So as the last note dies away, Yoko tentatively suggests livening up the bridge. But Paul cuts her off with a dismissive cough. Turns to John.
Maybe Yoko should take a more background role.
Background? Yoko's furious. She wants to tell him she's an established artist in her own right, celebrated by people far more critically astute than teenage Beatles fans. But before she gets the chance, John leaps to her defence.
No, this is my band. I brought her here, and you're going to listen.
But Yoko grabs John's arm to silence him. He's quiet in an instant. She turns to leave the studio. If she's going to prove her worth to the Beatles, she's going to do it on her own terms. August 25th, 1967, London. John sits down at the head of a long laminate table, resting his green leather boots up on a chair. He's flamboyantly dressed in a paisley shirt, a yellow Afghan coat embroidered with pink brocade, and purple velvet trousers. On the other side of the beige boardroom, Brian Epstein plays with the knot of his thin black tie and clears his throat with a curt cough. He's about to begin when George, Paul and Ringo file in, dressed in similarly decadent colours.
Thank you all for coming today.
The band share wry glances. They're not used to seeing Brian out of his depth.
This is Robert Stigwood.
He nods at the Bee Gees manager on his left in a grey pinstripe suit. John knows that Brian has been keen to leave the music industry for a while, move to Spain, settle down, maybe find a boyfriend. But the Beatles are adamant they won't be managed by anyone else. They might not have always seen eye to eye on every issue, but without Brian, there wouldn't be a band. To all of them, he's the fifth Beatle. There's no way they can lose him.
I feel sure today we can come up with a deal that will...
John waves his hand and Brian trails off nervously. The rest of the band snigger. They've rehearsed what's coming next.
I'm just going to stop you there, Bri. We don't want another manager. We won't have another manager. And if you somehow persuade us, we'll sing God Save the Queen out of tune on every record we do from now on.
Brian dries his forehead with a folded white handkerchief.
That may be, John, but you see, I've been struggling recently and I feel you'd benefit from someone sharper and...
But John's already rising to his feet.
No, there's no Beatles without Brian.
2 days later, Bangor, Wales. John's Rolls-Royce pulls up outside a red brick university building. The car has been custom painted yellow, with psychedelic swirls of blue, green and pink covering the bodywork. Seagulls circle overhead, and the air is thick with drizzle. Since meeting Yoko, he's been on a mission to expand his mind. He's determined to learn everything, experience everything. So he's got the band to join him here in Wales to try transcendental meditation, led by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Inside, the bland lecture theatre has been filled with yellow and orange flowers. Maharishi Mahesh sits at the front on an armchair draped in a white sheet. He wears a pristine silk cloth, a pearl necklace hanging from his neck. He doesn't open his eyes as the band enter, just puts out a hand. Enchanted, John slowly lowers himself to the floor and inhales, trying to block out the flashbulbs and creaking chairs from the journalists in the corner. Suddenly, a scuffle. Footsteps and hushed tones. Annoyed, John retorts,
"We're trying to achieve nirvana over here, lads."
But a clipped voice shatters the tranquility.
"Brian is dead."
John's eyes snap open.
"What?" "I'm sorry, lads. Brian Epstein. They're saying he's dead. Accidental overdose."
John feels the blood drain from his face as tears of guilt begin to roll down his cheeks.
Why does he feel guilt?
Well, John gave Brian his first amphetamine pill, so he kind of introduced that to him.
Brian had tried to stop. He'd begged them for help. Journalists are scribbling furiously now, aiming cameras at the band's drawn faces. Paul is wrapping Ringo in a hug. George is puffing hard on a cigarette. Maharishi Mahesh raises his arm.
"You must forget this. Embrace happiness."
John stares at the guru, dumbfounded. He's about to reply, but Paul gets there first.
"Oh, shut up, fucking idiot."
Suddenly, it all feels ridiculous. The meditation, the mantras. John sees the room for what it is, a musty lecture theatre full of half-dead plants. He stalks out of the room, crushing an orange chrysanthemum in his fist, stomach heavy with dread. John thinks back to the meeting 2 days before and the last words he uttered to Brian, that without him, there would be no Beatles. June 15th, 1968, Old Vic National Theatre, London. Yoko peers out of the limousine window. They're parked up by the entrance to the theatre. The junction has been blocked by police cars and hundreds of bodies are pressed up against the steel barriers, despite the summer heat. Her forehead stings with the noise of it all, the long, high, constant screams. Leering journalists with rolled-up sleeves and damp armpits line the entrance to the theatre like a pack of wolves.
"Ready?"
Next to her, John squeezes her hand. Yoko doesn't reply. She knows Brian would never have allowed her to be here, at the press night of a play based on John's book, in his own right. It was years before he allowed John's marriage to Cynthia to be made public. But Brian is dead. And a devastated, directionless, furious John said he wouldn't come tonight unless she was by his side. Yoko knew she couldn't refuse. But now, as she wrings her sweating hands, she's apprehensive. She might not care much for monogamy herself, but the British press certainly does. Being seen out with a married Beatle is a huge risk. Taking a deep breath, she knows she can't put it off any longer. She tells herself she can do this, that for John, she'll do anything. In an instant, the noise, the colours, the smells, it's overwhelming. Press storm her with questions.
"Who are you? Where's Cynthia?"
In a surge, the barriers give way. Fans flood towards them. Teenage girls are shouting in her face, so close she can feel their hot breath on her cheeks.
"How could you? He has a wife, a son!"
"You're so ugly. Go back to your own country, dragon lady."
I mean, this isn't just jealous fans. This is very aggressive, racist behaviour.
Tears prick in Yoko's eyes. She feels John's hand slip into hers. He's trying to direct her to the theatre's entrance, but it doesn't feel like they're moving forward at all. A girl reaches forward and pulls at her hair. Yoko's scalp burns. Something's pushed into her hand. Yoko yelps, feeling a swift jab of pain. She realises too late, it's a rose. Thorns first. As it falls to the floor, she sees the rose is yellow. A racist gesture. As John finally wrenches her into the foyer of the theatre, Yoko makes a decision. She's been reluctant to ask John to leave his wife. She knows Brian was one constant in John's life, and the other is Cynthia. But she isn't prepared to spend the rest of her life being treated with such disrespect, hostility, and hatred. If this is going to work, John is going to have to choose her or Cynthia. If you were a plus one of the Beatles, and it almost feels derogatory to say that about Yoko Ono because she was an artist in her own right, she wasn't just John's girlfriend. But if you were, then you got all of the raw side of that fame, didn't you? You didn't get any of the true benefit of being in the limelight.
Yes, what's driving a lot of that hatred is jealousy. These four young lads were sex symbols, and there will have been elements of British society, including in the media, that will have felt that if they are going to have girlfriends and wives, that they certainly shouldn't look like Yoko Ono.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
July 1968, Abbey Road Studios, London. John ushers Yoko into the recording booth. He can feel that her back is straight and her shoulder blades are tense. Paul's eyes narrow, but John's sure he'll understand. He just needs to hear this track. John and Yoko have spent all night on it. Revolution 9. Inspired by John's anti-violence protest song, Revolution, Yoko has suggested creating a soundscape of revolution, one that people don't have to understand, but feel. John gestures for Yoko to take a seat at the mixing desk and offers her a reassuring smile. She hadn't wanted to come in. After all, Paul had made it clear he didn't want her input. But John had convinced her. The track is brilliant, exactly the sort of music the band should be playing. And the Beatles have a platform. What better way to share her peaceful protest message with the world? John watches Yoko take a deep breath and begin. She starts by playing a recording of the original Revolution track, layering different loops over the top, crying, crowd noise, crackling fire, and gunshots. John joins in, sampling the sounds and distorting them. Finally, he turns back to the group. He's not used to feeling nervous about their opinion. George is nodding furiously. Yeah, I like it. It's psychedelic. He starts suggesting adding pieces of classical music. John grins, his heart rate's returning to normal. But then he sees Ringo is looking at Paul and that Paul is laughing. Yoko reddens and steps away from the desk, staring at the floor. Seething, John squares up to Paul and grabs the collar of his floral shirt. But Paul doesn't even blink.
Sorry, mate, I'm just not sure it's really us.
John's furious. Can't he see that's the problem? Paul grasps John's wrists. John loosens his grip.
Do we really think Yoko should be here? Isn't it a bit disrespectful to Cynthia? Your divorce papers aren't even signed. Look, let me show you something.
Paul slowly backs away from John, picks up his guitar and starts strumming a track of his own. Hey, Jules. John can't believe what he's hearing. Jules? As in, his Julian?
Yeah, but we can change it to whatever. Was playing it last night to your lad, and I thought there might be something in it.
You went to see Cynthia.
Paul nods, solemn, and says that they're having a tough time of it, in a sickly voice that makes John want to punch him. Furious, John shoves open the heavy soundproof door and storms out. Siding with his wife, playing house with his son. This is beyond the pale. John knows he hasn't been creatively aligned with Paul for a while. But for the first time, John feels betrayed by his friend and wonders if it's a gulf that can ever be fixed. August 1968, London. Yoko stands naked and alone in the large studio. She's surrounded by screens, cameras, wires. A shaft of light cuts across the room. The door slams as technicians rush in and out, bustling around her. After the fallout with Paul, she's keen to distance herself from the Beatles. So she and John are putting out their own album, Two Virgins, a series of soundscapes recorded during their first night of passion. This is a window into the couple's minds, their souls. If she's honest, she hopes when fans listen to it, they'll understand.
Understand what?
It.
But if you're Cynthia as well, not only...
I don't think Cynthia's buying it.
No!
I hadn't even thought of that. How awful.
That you've been humiliated, cheated on, and then there's an album of your husband and his mistress having it off.
It's sort of worst-case scenario, isn't it?
She hopes that they'll stop lunging at her in the street and shouting racist insults. Today, they're shooting the cover. Yoko has planned it all. She wants it to be just the two of them, real, naked, unfiltered.
Now, I would say I'm an open-minded person.
Would you?
Oh, yeah.
Radical.
In principle, you go, oh, yeah, nothing wrong with the human body. Yeah, absolutely. We all need to be mature about it. When someone is actually there, naked, doing this sort of thing, I always think, oh, come on. You could have done this with your clothes on. You're just showing off.
Because I pitched this as the cover for British Scandal, and you weren't very open-minded then.
Her mind's not on the shoot right now. Because this morning, she discovered that she's pregnant. Yoko knows this isn't the right time to have another child. She already has a 5-year-old, Kyoko, who lives with her father. And though she loves her daughter, she struggles to juggle the pressures of motherhood with her art. She's sure John will feel the same. It'll be best for both of them if she has a termination. John is already in position, wearing nothing but a wooden necklace. She goes to walk towards him, but all of a sudden she feels faint, like the world's lifting off without her. Her legs give way from under her, and she finds herself sagging to the splintered wooden floor. John urgently clears out the photographers before crouching down beside her and tenderly nuzzling her neck.
Yoko, tell me, what is it?
So with a deep breath, she tells him. She's about to reassure him that she's already made up her mind, when, to her shock, unbridled delight spreads across John's face.
That's fantastic.
Really? I thought...
This is exactly what we need. It's just the three of us now. You're all that matters.
Yoko smiles back at him weakly. She's glad John feels the way he does. But as she looks up at his delighted face, she realizes she's still unsure of her own feelings. She's never seen herself playing happy families with John. But she loves him, and if he wants to keep the child, that's what she'll do. She just hopes it proves to be the right decision. October 18th, 1968, 34 Montague Square, Marylebone, London. Yoko wakes to the soft brush of John's lips on her forehead, moving slowly down her chest to the small curve of her stomach.
You never look me in the eye when I read lines like that.
It is a bit awkward, isn't it?
Yeah, we're very close to each other in a sealed room.
I just feel like a naughty schoolboy.
The basement flat, rented to them by Ringo, is light, airy, uncluttered. Yoko has painted every wall white and hung white floor-to-ceiling drapes, allowing pale winter sunlight to spill into the room. She smiles and decides she wants nothing more than to spend the day in bed in the sanctuary of their home. Lying back on the pillow, she thinks about how clear and sharp she feels. Since finding out about the pregnancy, she and John have been keen to cut down on drinking and drugs. And Yoko enjoys waking up completely sober. John has been extra affectionate too. She's starting to let herself get excited about the idea of the baby. Perhaps this child will be different, a source of light and inspiration, hope and creativity. Suddenly, a furious banging on the door.
Police!
John jumps up, his panicked eyes flitting from her to the door.
Don't open it, John. What if it's fans? Press!
But John shakes his head gravely.
No, it's definitely the police.
But she has no time to wonder how he can be so sure. Flecks of glass fly across the room as a battering ram ploughs through the bay window. Heavy black boots hammer into the room, crunching shattered glass into the herringbone floor. The bald detective inspector barely turns in her direction, just nods to his colleagues. Within seconds, the room is swarming with officers, dragging two drooling German shepherds on leather leads. Yoko is terrified. John stumbles into a pair of trousers, demanding in vain for the police to be careful. Yoko watches from bed, horrified, as her white sanctuary is torn apart. Books are opened and then thrown across the room, cabinets pulled off the walls. The eiderdown is snatched from her and cut open with a penknife. John risks a smile at her and whispers that he's had a tip-off from a journalist friend. It's okay. He cleared the place from top to bottom. But just as Yoko's about to relax, the smug detective inspector announces they've found something. John squares up to the guy, brazen.
Impossible.
The detective inspector triumphantly opens a battered leather binocular case and pulls out a small handful of marijuana. Hardly enough for one joint. The case can't have been opened in months. John must have forgotten it was there. Yoko manages to grab a shirt and trousers before the inspector starts reading her her rights, clipping cold steel handcuffs around her wrists.
This does feel a bit over the top for a bit of ganja.
This is not the Matt I know and love. You'd have said 20 to life, I would have thought.
I mean, that stuff will have dried out, won't it? It's probably not even active. is that the right word?
It's not a bath bomb.
Outside, a crowd of press has already gathered. They pull at her clothes as she passes, spit questions into her face. Yoko frantically twists around, desperate to catch a glimpse of John, before the police van opens and she's shoved onto the cold metal bench. Then the doors are slammed shut and everything goes black. A month later, the 21st of November, 1968, King's College Hospital, London. John rests his head on the rough, starched hospital bedsheets and grips Yoko's small, cold hand. Yoko's room, separated from the ward by a plasterboard wall, is full of half-eaten fruit, unread books, and scrunched-up sketch paper. The scent of disinfectant fills his nostrils. They've been here for weeks now. After the stress of the arrest, Yoko was admitted to hospital on John's 29th birthday with tight, searing pains. Doctors were grave about their baby's chances and put Yoko on immediate bed rest. But John is hopeful. Yoko is tough and they've got the best doctors money can afford. He spent almost every day by her side, reading to their unborn son and playing him music. But he struggled. Last night, he returned to the flat for the first time since the raid. He was shocked by how empty the place felt. Friends had done their best to tidy up the debris left by the police. But everything had felt off, out of place,
like this was not quite home. A baby's Moses basket lay propped up by the bed. He'd felt a deep sense of loneliness overwhelm him. And in a moment of weakness, he'd turned to the one thing he knew would make all his pain disappear. Heroin. But it was just a one-off, he tells himself. He needs to stay sharp, strong, for Yoko and the baby. John feels Yoko's hand tighten around his. She winces. He looks down to see bright red spreading across the white bedsheets.
Help! We need help!
His voice comes out raw, manic. Within seconds, the room is full of doctors and nurses. John feels a hand on his shoulder and realises he's being manhandled out of the room. For a split second, his eyes meet Yoko's. They're wide, desperate. She looks so small. And then he's out on the ward, watching through the mesh window as a doctor prepares a blood transfusion. A needle disappears into Yoko's pale arm. John's legs feel weak under him. John realises in panic that it's not just the baby's life in danger. He could lose Yoko too. The 2 hours that follow are the longest John can remember. He paces up and down a corridor under harsh strip lighting, not registering anything or anyone. Finally, a doctor takes him by the arm. He's washed his hands, but John can see a speck of blood on his shirt collar. It takes several seconds for his words to sink in.
Yoko will pull through.
John feels the tension leave his body. Before he looks up and realises the doctor hasn't finished talking.
But I'm sorry. We couldn't save the baby.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
March 20th, 1969, Gibraltar Airport. Yoko grabs John's hand and with 6-year-old Kyoko propped on her hip, runs across the concourse to the private plane. Behind, she hears the familiar click of flashbulbs. It's been a whirlwind few weeks. After the devastating loss of their son, John decided to propose.
Okay, he's done that again.
Yeah, of course, because he did it with Cynthia. It feels like a really obvious reflex, actually, when something really catastrophic happens to try and create some stability. And that's my bit on psychoanalysing John Lennon. The ceremony had been small and intimate, but still, somehow, the press had found out. Yoko slumps into her seat and gazes out at the journalists flocking below the jet window. Her mind is working overtime. She half hears John promise that he'll organise security for when they land. But she turns to him, shaking her head.
Or we could invite them in?
John is incredulous, But she continues. Wherever they go, the press will find them. Maybe it's time to play them at their own game. Use the attention to their advantage. The whole world is watching them while Vietnam burns. If she can't enjoy her honeymoon, she's going to damn well do some good for the world.
We'll call it a bed-in for peace.
The next day, Yoko, John and Kyoko sit cross-legged on a plush king-size bed at the Hilton Hotel in Amsterdam, surrounded by pots and brushes. On every wall, they've stuck hand-drawn signs. Give peace a chance. Hair peace. I love Yoko. All three of them wear white pyjamas. White bouquets fill the room. Yoko looks at John. Apprehensive, she tells him,
"It's time to let the world in."
She watches as he walks across the room, hoping it will all go to plan. As soon as the door opens, 30 journalists in dark, cheap suits barrel in, filling the room with the scent of stale sweat and cigarettes. Their eyes scan her and John on the bed. She can see they're disappointed they're not naked. Microphones are thrust in their faces. A ruddy-faced man in his 70s denounces the whole thing as a publicity stunt. Yoko smiles. She expected this. She throws up her hands and begins to speak.
"Well, you weren't giving publicity to the suffering in Vietnam, so we had to take matters into our own hands. So..."
But the journalist barely looks at her.
"I was talking to your husband."
"Dickhead."
She feels John's sharp intake of breath, ready to leap to her defence. But this is her moment.
"I'm sorry. Maybe I'd be better speaking about our cause to one of the more reputable papers, instead of a rag that'll be wrapping tomorrow's chips."
And smiling serenely, she turns to the New York Times journalist and begins describing her hopes for a better world, leaving the old hack chewing on his words. For the last year, she's put her art on the back burner for John. But this is like the installations she used to do in New York. She feels her sense of self and purpose return. Her power. Her voice. And she decides it's about time that she's heard. April 1969, Twickenham Studios, London. Paul glances at his watch nervously. John is over 2 hours late. He takes a deep breath, knows he can't get worked up. He thinks of Brian, his deft touch, his ability to diffuse situations. Since he's been gone, this responsibility has fallen on Paul's shoulders, and he's feeling the pressure. The White Album recording sessions were acrimonious, fragmented. All four Beatles installed themselves in separate rooms, with George Martin having to mediate between them.
You should know, listening to this, that Alice and I now record this in separate rooms.
And we get private jets. We're not even on the same one anymore, are we?
Yeah, if you're trying to picture us, I'm basically facing the wall in the corner of a separate room.
And I'm in the Bahamas.
He's determined that recording Let It Be will be better. And for the sake of the band, he and John will rediscover what they had. On the phone last night, John had sworn that he'd arrived back from his honeymoon feeling more refreshed and creative than ever in his life. But when John finally staggers into the room, he looks awful. Skin pale and sallow, cheeks hollow, collarbone visible. Paul tries to press on.
"So I'm thinking with this, let's go back to basics, rock and roll, do what we do best."
But John, always the most alert, hyperactive and opinionated member of the group, stays quiet, gazing spaced out into the middle distance. Paul feels irritation rise in his chest. Clearly, he's high. Through gritted teeth, Paul starts handing out lyric sheets.
"See what you boys think, yeah?"
But George barely looks down at the piece of paper.
Paul, mate.
He tentatively gestures for him to step out of the recording booth, brow furrowed with concern. In the empty corridor, Paul listens as George, in hushed tones, suggests they intervene, find John some help. Again, Paul feels his chest tighten.
He's tried speaking to John before about his drug use, about his son's death, but it always ends in hostility and slammed doors. He can't seem to find the right words to talk to his old friend anymore. Maybe it's better they leave it, concentrate on the music. But George looks him dead in the eye. This isn't about the band. They could lose their friend here. Paul stays silent. Thoughts of Brian weigh heavy on his mind. Slowly, he nods, sticks his head back through the recording studio door.
John, could I borrow you for a minute, mate?
In a quiet corner, with framed photographs of heady Beatles concerts lining the walls, Paul faces John. He's not even sure where to start. He decides this is stupid. This is John. Best mates since they were teenagers. He shouldn't have to choose his words.
We've been talking and we think you should get some treatment. The Priory, maybe. We'll give you all the time you need.
This is so hard for Paul because obviously the fact that it's Paul McCartney and John Lennon gives it a specific dynamic. But it's hard for any friend if you're a young person to try and help a mate in this sort of situation.
Yeah, and they're almost family, really, aren't they? I mean, I always think with situations like this, with that level of fame, you're sort of insulated from the world in a strange way.
And now with Brian Epstein dead, their father figure's gone, so Paul effectively has had to become the man of the house and he's not prepared for it.
John throws back his head and laughs menacingly.
You know what this is? You boys can't stand that I'm on another level. I've left the Beatles behind. Deal with it.
Paul tries to cut in.
Come on, mate, you don't mean that.
But John's already shoving open a fire exit and storming out into the car park. Paul looks up at a photograph of the four of them in sharp black suits and thin ties. He remembers the day it was taken. The day they met their hero, Elvis Presley. Back when they felt unstoppable. For the first time in 9 years, Paul wonders if there's even a band left to keep fighting for. April 1969, London. In a small artist's studio, yellow paint peeling from the walls, sunlight streaming through the barred window, Yoko is hard at work. The plywood bench is strewn with recording, audio, and editing equipment. She selects the tape and clips it into the slot. Her finger hovers over the play button. She tells herself she can do this. The drugs, the alcohol, they only postpone the pain. If she wants to get through this, she has to put her faith in the redemptive power of art. Before she can stop herself, Yoko hits play. The tape crackles into life. On the recording, she hears herself laugh. Then John's voice tells the sonographer he's ready. And all of a sudden, for 5 minutes and 10 seconds, the room is full of the light, constant fluttering of their lost baby's heartbeat. Yoko gets to work editing the recording, keeping its rough, raw essence. She wants to release it on an album, to let the world know that her baby lived. As she plays back the finished track, she closes her eyes. A wave of cathartic calm washes over her. The double doors to the studio swing open, and Yoko is flung from her reverie. John is marching across the wooden floor, talking 19 to the dozen before he's even reached her.
That's it. I started the band, and I'm going to finish it.
Yoko's thrown. She tells him there's no need to be so rash. They could just take a break. Make some work separately, and then come back together, feeling refreshed.
This obviously isn't the narrative, that Yoko installed herself in the Beatles and was entirely disruptive. She's suggesting to him that they do work separately.
And she sees the benefit of the Beatles. She sees that that's a great outlet for John. And also she has all of her own work going on. What's the appeal for her to have the Beatles crumble, particularly at this point?
But John is adamant. He firmly declares that he's ashamed of all the music they've made together. He's beyond them now.
The Beatles are dead. It's just me and you now.
He flings his arms around her triumphantly.
From inside his stifling grasp, Yoko's stomach lurches. She can see the headlines now. She's already hounded with racist abuse wherever she goes. If she gets scapegoated for the breakup of the band, her life will be a living hell.
John, I'm begging you. You can't do this.
He loosens his grip on her. To Yoko's horror, she sees hurt beginning to spread across his face. He thought she'd be pleased. Softening, she tries to find the words to explain.
It's just, you have your work, and I have mine.
John shrugs, belligerent.
Not anymore. It's you and me against the world.
As he perches himself on her desk and begins sorting through her edits, Yoko is consumed with a new dread. She worries this might not just be the end of the band, but also the end of their relationship.
Hello, Prime members. You can listen to British Scandal ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This is the second episode in our series, The Ballad of Yoko and John.
A quick note about our dialogue. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said, but all our dramatisations are based on historical research.
If you'd like to know more about this story, you can read John by Cynthia Lennon, John Lennon, The Life by Philip Norman, and Yoko Ono, An Artful Life by Donald Brackett.
I'm Matt Ford.
And I'm Alice Levine. Lydia Marchant wrote this episode. Additional writing by Alice Levine and Matt Ford. Sound design by Granny Eats Wolf. Script editing by James Magniak. British Scandal is produced by Samizdat Audio. Our associate producer is Francesca Gilardi Quadrio Corsio. Our producer is Millie Chu. The senior producer is Joe Sykes. Our managing producers are Tonja Thigpin and Matt Gant. Our executive producers are Jenny Lower Beckman, Stephanie Jens, and Marshall Louis for Wondery.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.